Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, of course, we are taking a deep dive on WannaCry. Most of the coverage of this debacle has actually been, well, at least in my opinion, pretty bad. And there's nothing that I've seen that even approaches being comprehensive. So we're going to try as best we can to fix that in this week's edition of the show. This week's podcast is sponsored by Silence, and they did an ambulance chase this interview, just so you know. They booked this sponsor slot in January of this year. Silence's CEO, Stuart McClure, joins the show to talk about that ambulance chasing that's been going on, why it is that we still don't have a decent technical analysis of WannaCry, and he also generally just gives us an industry view on this thing. We will, of course, be covering off other news stories as well, but I have ditched this week's feature interview so that Adam and I can go long on WannaCry. Let's get into it now, Adam. And just for the listeners out there, I should point out that what I've done here this week is I've had to type up a bunch of notes and tried to structure a bit of a narrative around our WannaCry discussion because basically, look, the malware itself is pretty simple, but the circumstances around it, the history here, the chaos it's caused, and the fallout, all of that is actually pretty complicated, which is why a lot of the coverage has been pretty lacking. So we're going to try to cover off the whole thing to the best of our ability and get through these notes. And Adam, look, why don't we just start at the beginning? How did this unfold?
So on Saturday morning my time, and I guess middle of the night for other people last week, we had a piece of ransomware start doing the rounds, WannaCry, as it's been dubbed based on some of its internal names. And it's, you know, a fairly common garden piece of ransomware. It infects your machine by some means. It starts encrypting your files. It demands a ransom notice via Bitcoin. It has a command and control network via Tor. You pay your money. Maybe you get some keys to decrypt your files. Relatively standard. The interesting bit about this one from a, you know, the point of view of the actual malware is it uses bugs from the Shadow Broker's dump, the Eternal Blue remote Windows SMB exploit. It uses that to propagate, and it will, like a traditional SMB worm, scan the local network and parts of the internet for machines that have open SMB and infect them as its primary propagation vector, unlike most other ransomware we've seen, which you know uses email spamming, delivery, you know, word macros, that kind of thing to get onto people's boxes. So we haven't really seen, you know, a very traditional SMB worm in quite a while, actually, and one that's tied up with a piece of ransomware is, you know, sort of moderately interesting. The bug.
I like that you're discussing the, you know, probably one of the biggest stories we've covered on this show as moderately interesting. But
well,
do go on.
That's the thing, right? I mean, the actual piece of ransomware is pretty common garden, right? It uses an off-the-shelf public bug. It's, you know, got competent kind of workaday crypto. The command and control mechanism is Tor, so at least it's, you know, relatively resilient. The mechanism for getting your keys out of it is below average compared to other ransomware in that it appears to be a manual process at the other end. They have no way of validating, like some, you know, some fancier pieces of ransomware have a Bitcoin address, you know, per host that gets ransomed so that they can programmatically determine who's paid and give out the keys automatically without.
Yeah, this one is like, you know, Jenny in accounts is working overtime to try to, you know, match Bitcoin transactions to hosts. But yeah. Look, you know, just straight off the bat, which versions of Windows have been affected by this? Because we know that the Eternal Blue exploit affects everything from XP up to, I think, Windows 8, and I am reliably informed that it will work on Windows 10 with a bit of tweaking that takes into account changes to the Windows kernel. But it's not quite clear which versions of Windows are actually suffering from encrypted files. I mean, we don't know that 5 days later, we don't know.
Exactly. Even basics like that are surprisingly hard to come by. I mean, I had a really good rummage looking for someone who says conclusively, I have this on XP. The bug, as you say, Eternal Blue does affect XP and totally works. But all of the examples you see are on Win 7. I haven't actually seen, I mean, if you Google, you see some screenshots of XP desktops with the WannaCrypt, you know, encryption screen on it. But
yeah, but you also Google for it and you find that image photoshopped onto things like home pregnancy tests. Do you know what I mean? Photoshop field day.
Yeah, like making the, you know, masthead images for your rubbish reporting on this, you know, there's a lot of badly photoshopped images, that's for sure. So yeah, it's kind of hard to say. And like, it's ridiculous that we are this many days and we haven't got a good answer. And we were going to run it up in the office here and have a play with it. But, you know, we've all got actual jobs to be doing. Like surely, you know, the AV people, you know, for whom this would be their bread and butter thing to do easily, would be able to just tell us. But anyway, Microsoft say that it affects XP in the sense of the bug, but no one, I don't know, I haven't seen it on an XP box, but I also don't have very many real XP boxes, and certainly not one on the internet with OpenXP.
Yeah, look, I heard that this, you know, the impact of this thing varies from file encryption to just like a really nasty DOS on versions that it doesn't affect. But again, that's impossible to verify. Let's take a step back for a moment, Adam, and look at which organizations were impacted. The NHS in England suffered terribly at the hands of this worm, as did a Spanish telco. We've even seen ports in your country, like actual shipping ports, closed because of this. The impact has been quite severe, considering this is a worm that exploits a bug that was patched in March.
Yeah, I mean, the big ones that got the media coverage were, of course, as you said, the NHS. I mean, they were turning away people from hospitals for non-critical surgery because they couldn't get, you know, test results. They couldn't get the technological support for the medical staff. And that's, you know, as impact goes, that's pretty bad. And then we saw reports from, you know, internal networks on FedEx.com, Telefonica in Spain, as you mentioned. There were some initial reports of really quite high infection rates in Russia, although I haven't really seen, you know, there hasn't been a lot of reporting about, you know, actual business impact as a result of that. There's been screenshots of, you know, the train system in Germany somewhere getting, I think it was Frankfurt maybe. So there's definitely been a fair amount around, lots of screenshots on Twitter of people spotting it in shop windows and, you know, other places with automated displays. But yeah, there's definitely been some, you know, there's the actual impact of the ransomware. And then there's also the sort of the impact of people failing to deal with the idea that it exists badly. And that was the case in New Zealand. There's been media reports of, as you said, a container shipping container terminal shutting down because they're going to go patch all their stuff, which, you know, hopefully they would have done previously. But, you know, they're, you know, self-dossing because of the, you know, the reporting around this being quite sensationalist. So yeah, there's a mixture of impacts from, you know, from the real through to the imagined.
Now, look, it must be said, we don't actually know what the initial vector was here. We've seen some people claim it was email. But there's been no evidence to back that up. And indeed, there was another ransomware campaign going around via email called Jaff, and it seems like some people have conflated the two together. It's entirely possible that this one was purely a network worm.
Yeah, it's kind of strange, Adam. There's a number of technically curious aspects of this worm, and that lack of an initial vector is definitely one of them. I mean, the narrative that it was email delivered, you know, was quite big in the first kind of day or two when people didn't have a clear handle on it. And I think you're right. The Jaff ransomware that was doing the rounds via email, you know, did do quite a big spike of mail traffic about the same time. So it wasn't an unreasonable sort of a guess that they were related.
It gets confusing, though, because Australia has walked away from this virtually unscathed. And you'd say, oh, well, of course, it's the time zones, right? Because this bloke in Britain, Malware Tech Blog, you know, he noticed this thing trying to reach out to a domain. So he registered the domain to see what would happen. And it turned out that what the malware authors had done was they got the malware to try to reach out for this domain, expecting it not be there, right? And it would continue if it wasn't there. If it was there, the malware assumed that it was in some sort of sandbox and just didn't do anything further. So it was actually an anti-analysis technique, and that stopped it dead. So, you know, the idea, hey, no one's at work, so that would have stopped its stopped the worm in its tracks. That would make a lot of sense until you consider that it was a network worm and it doesn't require human interaction. So how have we got off scot-free? There's still unanswered questions here.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, the number of infections in New Zealand also seems relatively low. You know, we've had very few reports of it actually happening. So yeah, that's definitely one of the unanswered questions. We don't know exactly why it propagated like it did. I mean, there's not a lot of SMB on the internet compared to the old days.
No, and you'd think, you know, email network hybrid, I mean, they're the ones that do the best, right? Because they get behind your firewall into your, you know, into your LAN because someone opens it up via email and then it spreads like wildfire through an internal network. But
yeah,
look, one thing
that
we should
make sense.
Yeah, it does. But we don't have any evidence that that's what's actually happened.
I agree.
And look, you know, another thing that's worth pointing out is this is the second worm to actually use this SMB exploit. Proofpoint apparently discovered that the Adilkas, the so-called Adilkas, I think that's how you pronounce it, it's a cryptocurrency mining botnet. It mines Monero coins. And they say that kicked off between April 26 and May 2, just didn't get the same traction, didn't get the same attention. It sort of flew under the radar. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a really interesting twist because, of course, all of the organizations that were, you know, quote, emergency patching, unquote, because of this, you know, really did miss the boat because there was, you know, other worms during the rounds. And indeed, this wasn't even the first version of this WannaCry worm. There was an earlier couple of test releases that people seem to have found, you know, lurking around on VirusTotal and that sort of thing. But yeah, this is far from the first case where these bugs are being used or indeed being wormed at all, which, yeah, that's a thing that people really shouldn't overlook, I think. Like, I mean, a lot of people feel like we dodged a bullet with this particular worm because it wasn't as bad as it could have been. But there's plenty of machines that were already owned. And in fact, that Adelkaz, or whatever it's called, worm actually was turning off SMB after it had exploited things. So the, what, couple hundred thousand machines that it appears to have picked up, those were ones that would have been WannaCry'd had they been hit by its scanner.
Yeah. So it's better to have your box hosed and sit there mining cryptocurrency than, you know, all of your files encrypted. You know, if you're gonna get owned, that's a softer way for that to happen. We should also point out too that there's been something doing the rounds. Look, a lot of people are saying that this worm, WannaCry, used the Metasploit implementation of the Eternal Blue Flaw. That is incorrect. The Metasploit module wasn't released until after the worm started spreading. This incorrect information was doing the rounds because a researcher at Endgame just used careless wording. They'd used the Metasploit module to sort of understand the how this exploit works. And in their write-up, they sort of were just a little bit careless with their wording and made it appear that it was actually the Metasploit module. So that's been another little confusing thing there. I mean, it's not entirely their fault. People just sort of inferred from that a little bit inaccurately, and they've since cleared it up. So there is that. We can assure you that it wasn't the Metasploit version of the exploit. But the thing is, it just as well could have been, right? Which is which takes NSA out of the mix, and we're gonna get into that whole argument in a bit. Let's have a look at Microsoft's response. They have actually patched. They've released patches for unsupported operating systems, which is something you rarely, well, I can't remember this happening before, but they've released patches for Windows 2003, Windows 2008, Vista, and XP.
Yeah, I think there's been one example of Microsoft releasing a post-update patch for XP, and that was like the week after XP was end-of-lifed, and it was a bug that was going to live forever if they didn't patch it, and you know, it being only a week, they relented and released that one. But yeah, this is, you know, XP's been dead for a good few years now. And what look, it looks like what's happened is that the like really, really, really expensive in like post end of life support program that you can buy, Microsoft obviously were maintaining the patches for those people and have decided to just release it to try and, you know, mitigate the impact of, you know, of the really bad headlines, bad publicity for them. And, you know, they were going to sit down in the office and sit on the bug.
Yeah, we'll get into the PR aspect of this because I've been wrangling with Microsoft's PR agency, at least here in Australia over the last few days, and that's been a whole other level of bizarre. But I mean, Microsoft is in a bit of an impossible situation here. They've been telling people to switch off SMB v1 for a long time. They have been issuing that advice for a long time. They've been telling people, do not run XP for a long time. So they can't support these operating systems forever. But to stockpile these patches, you know, when we're talking about such an elevated risk, also seems like maybe not the best decision, especially in light of what's happened. So their response to all of this seems to be to attack the NSA. Microsoft's general counsel wrote a long blog post taking aim at the NSA for so-called stockpiling of exploits, which just seems an odd response. Well, I mean, it depends how you view it. If you're viewing their response as being mostly motivated through PR and to deflect attention from the fact that this was a flaw in Microsoft's products, then it's quite smart.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix. I mean, I think one of the things that I was going to get to just a second ago with the patching that relates to the PR angle of it is the patch they released for XP was MSO 1710, which is the patch for SMB, which fixed three of the kind of eternal NSA bugs, Eternal Blue and a couple of others. They didn't release the patches for the other bugs that were in there, like, for example, the RDP remote that affects Windows 2003 and XP. They're sitting on a patch for that, clearly, because they're being paid to do so, and they didn't release that just because this worm didn't use that particular bug, which, you know, does make it look like a rather cynical PR thing rather than a, you know, considering the good of their customers, they should probably release that one too, right? And all of the
Yeah, but they don't want to encourage people to keep using these crappy old OSs, right? And that's why I say they're in an impossible situation. The really bizarre part of all of this is I actually reached out to Microsoft to ask them, hey, are you still running your XP extended support program and extended support programs for things like Server 2003 and whatnot? They refused to even answer that question, which is just wild, right? And then it was brought to my attention that the timestamps on the patches that Microsoft dropped were from 11th of February. Okay, so they had these patches, didn't release them. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's the wrong decision, but for them to then turn around and blame NSA just seems a bit, you know, look, if you're going to put it on them, you've got to wear some of it yourself, you know?
Yeah, I mean, clearly they are stuck in a really difficult position there, and they have to kind of, you know, you can imagine sitting in that meeting and having, you know, having to make that call, like, are we going to release some of these patches? Are we not? What are we going to do? And obviously, you know, one is release the patches. Two, let's deflect some flack onto the NSA and blame them for not telling us about these bugs earlier. And I mean, they their general counsel posted this blog post describing, referring his previous, I think it was RSA presentation about, you know, there being a, you know, there being a need for a digital Geneva Convention in scare quotes, which is, you know, clearly not well, entirely I think well it's, thought it's, through idea. But
I think it's what Mara Tam has described as the most stupid f-ing idea she's ever seen, actually, that post. But yeah, and you know, look, I understand NSA is taking heat over this. They did lose control of an exploit, and you know, that has contributed to this. We'll get into why and how, and you know, the circumstances under which that by which that happened in a moment, because we do actually have some fresh information on that. But I just want to ask listeners to consider one thing, because I know that a lot of listeners to this podcast would be saying, hey, you know, the NSA's got to wear some of this. And look, that's fair enough. But I want to ask you this. If the National Security Agency had stolen Russia's zero day, released it on the internet, and then someone wrote this worm, would you blame Russia? Okay.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Which, you know, just let's just change the players a little bit. Or would you blame the NSA in that circumstance? Now, if you're going to blame the NSA in that circumstance, you kind of have to level a little bit more blame at Russia in this circumstance, given that Russia is behind shadow brokers.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid thought experiment, right? Because yes. we would, right? It's such a difficult and complicated circumstance, right? With all of these bugs and the motivations of all the different players flying around. And we saw we'll get to it in a second. We saw the shadow brokers show up today with a new blog post talking about this particular worm and, you know, about the process by which they dropped the bugs and the timelines. And it's just such an interesting and bizarre circumstance we find ourselves in.
Well, and it's funny too.
It gets worse.
And Shadowbrokers, yeah, look, we'll get into all of that in a minute. But first off, it might be worth pointing out too that the Washington Post has just run a story that says background sources have claimed that these exploits have been linked to the Halliburton breach. Now, this is something we've been beating that drum pretty hard on this show since last year, since around the time Halliburton got arrested, that, hey, maybe this guy took some stuff, put it on his private network, and his private network got owned. He has been charged with 20 counts of, I think it's willfully retaining national defense material, not a charge of leaking it, which makes me think that this material was obtained from him somehow. Now, there was a leak hunt after he was arrested, and the only thing I can infer from that is that whoever owned his private network did a pretty good job cleaning up after themselves, because, you know, they could time that, obviously, because they were controlling the release of the information. So they're like, hey, we're going to release this stuff. Let's burn down that op, remove themselves from that network. So there's no way, I'm guessing, for FBI investigators to conclusively know if that's how this happened. But Halliburton, more and more, linked to this breach.
Yeah, that's definitely. It was the first like corroboration we've seen of this theory in, you know, in any other outlet other than Risky Business. So that's kind of nice to see.
Yes, it is. It is. I'm not feeling smug at all over here. Now, look, for its part, the NSA does appear to have done the right thing. Eventually, they probably could have been a little quicker off the mark, but it does appear that they certainly did inform Microsoft about the details of these bugs, so that Microsoft could get them into the March. Patch Tuesday. And I get the feeling Shadow Brokers would not have dumped Zero Day, basically. I think they waited for the patch. Is that your feeling as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what you get from the most recent blog post of theirs, which kind of, I mean, to the extent that we can attribute this, I don't think it was actually signed, so we're not 100% sure it's them. But
well, it went out through their Twitter account, right? So, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, you always got a question, right? But no, it does kind of allude to them controlling the timeline of released to make it post-patch and to not be dropping Irresponsible 0 Day, which is kind of funny given that they're dropping Irresponsible 0 Day. But, yeah, it does seem that, you know, they assert that it does match up with the missed patch Tuesday and the subsequent timeline of patching the Eternal class of bugs.
Now, speaking of this latest Shadow Brokers release, they say they're launching a subscription service which is going to dump new stuff, and they've given us a preview of what they've got. They say they have handset exploits, all of the browser packs, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Now, this would be, I mean, browser, you know, the NSA's browser pack. Geez, I hope they've given Microsoft a heads up on that, because if that dropped as O-Day, that would make WannaCry look like a picnic.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, browser bugs are very much a big deal. I mean, almost as big deal as Tavasso's antivirus bugs. But, yeah, now that will be really interesting to see. And, of course, handset exploits. You know, everybody loves iOS remotes. They are big money bugs. So that will be fun to see drop out. They're also threatening to drop ops disks. You remember when they dropped the data about the particular intrusion into Eastnet, the Swift broker in the Middle East, that they have a bunch more of that kind of you know, operational log data. That is a really interesting one. And they do specifically call out more Swift providers and central banks and compromised network data from Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, nuclear missiles, and other interesting things. So yeah, there's definitely, you know, both tools and operational data that they're teasing. And of course, yes, some exploits for Windows 10, which would be we'll see how. I mean, the Shadow Brokers are, you know, they talk a lot of smack, and they do eventually seem to deliver. So I'm sure this will show up one day, whether a monthly subscription in June. We'll see.
Android Worm could be next, and that'd be a world first and kind of interesting, right? Mm. So, or an iPhone worm. Imagine an iPhone crypto locker worm. As we've already discussed, the malware itself was pretty garden variety. That said, I saw a few tweets doing the rounds that claimed that there was a link to the Lazarus Group, which is in turn linked to North Korea and the North Korean government, the Sony breach, that whole disaster. Now, that's normally the sort of thing that you would dismiss, but I actually happened to catch who the person making the links was, and it was Neil Mehta. Okay. I'd read up a semantic blog post that actually described some of the similarities with the Lazarus Group. And I've got to say, at this point, it looks quite plausible, mostly because this malware is hardly advanced. So it seems unlikely that they would be throwing subtle false flags into it. If they're capable of doing that, they're capable of writing better malware. So it would seem that we're in this crazy position where North Korea really is getting into the cybercrime biz. And it's not outrageous to suggest that. We've seen them involved in the heroin business and smuggling heroin into countries like Australia in the past. And we have seen the Swift banks, which have been attributed to North Korea. So it seems they're in the crypto locker ransomware business now.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this, you know, these attribution sort of ideas pop up, and I was initially skeptical, as you were. And the more, you know, it doesn't look quite as crazy as it sounds, unfortunately. I mean, you kind of want it to be crazy, because it just, what does this say about the world that we're living in, where North Korea is ransomwaring things? But the thing is,
well, no. When North Korea is ransomwaring things with NSA exploits stolen by the Russians for made up money, which is called cryptocurrency. I mean, it's great. You wouldn't even understand what I just said if you heard it 10 years ago.
No, exactly. It's nuts. And the thing that I guess, I mean, there's a couple of reasons that it could plausibly be North Korea, other than the technical tells, right? I mean, it's kind of rubbish. I mean, the ransomware is not very well executed. Like, if you were an actual organized crime group, you could make so much more money. And there's plenty of examples of ransomware making tens of millions of dollars. Like, this is
made, yeah, I think they're up around the 70K mark.
Yeah, it's a rubbish amount of money. You would make more like selling, like almost any other way to monetize that group of machines would have made more money.
Like, okay, so Adam, the question becomes, is this political messaging or crimeware for profit? And that's not a crazy question, given what's happening on the Korean Peninsula right now. Beyond that, we know that North Korea cooperates with Iran on cyber matters, that is on the public record, and we know that Russia and Iran are cooperating in the Middle East. So I'm wondering, I mean, something that feels right to me is that maybe North Korea was egged on to do this. Like, go on, do it. It'll be fun. Do you know what I mean? You'll make lots of money. Why not use this? That feels like a plausible scenario, and I can't even believe I'm saying that.
But one of the other explanations I have heard put forward is that North Korea outsourced it to somebody else, and it's the same somebody else that they outsourced the Lazarus Group bits to, and that it's that crew not necessarily operating under North Korean guidance, but it just, you know, reusing some of the same tooling or whatever, and it's not actually North Korea. But the problem is that's
plausible,
it's just not
as well.
Competent.
I mean, that is plausible as well until we start seeing the SIGINTAs leaking. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
once
we've got more details
on CNC and whatever.
That's going to be the interesting bit, because we saw that with the Sony, you know, like a few months after the Sony thing went down, we started to get, you know, a little bit of chit chat from the SIGINTAs on the sly that actually, yes, it really was North Korea. And, you know, 6 months from now, maybe we'll have that same kind of, rumored confirmation.
But they're definitely in the mix. I mean, you can't say they're not in the mix.
No, it's absolutely a plausible option that it is DPRK and it is just political messaging. I mean, clearly it's not about money because it was rubbish,
I don't know, because, you know, it was an experiment, right? Maybe they expected this thing to be a slow burn and just a nice little trickle of money. I mean, you know, it's only up to 70 grand at time of recording, but that still buys a lot of laminated posters of Kim Jong-un to hand out to devotees. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Like, another angle we've seen discussed with this DPRK thing is that, oh, it's got a kill switch and only nation states use kill switches, which I don't really buy. I think the angle of it being anti-analysis, yeah, I think that makes a lot more sense. So I disregard that particular angle, but I don't know. It's just the world's gone nuts, man. It's nuts that we're having this conversation and we're actually plausibly considering that it is a rogue national state taking out hospitals in Britain essentially by accident. I mean, they didn't know the NHS was going to get wrecked.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that, right? Because let's talk about why something based on a patched bug worked out so terribly. And I think, and especially when you look at hospitals, I know people who work at hospitals. I know of one person who I know who is the only IT person at the entire hospital. And there's a very simple reason behind that, which is when they get budget, the choice always comes down to things like, do I hire another doctor or do I spend money on a blinky light box? They hire the doctor. So when you look at, you know, the cost of a desktop refresh in a large hospital versus the cost of hiring more doctors, you're going to hire more doctors. That's just what you're going to do. And it is the right thing to do. And this is where it's going to get a bit controversial for some of the listeners. I still think that they're better off taking the hit from something like this than spending gazillions of dollars on IT, because you're going to get better patient outcomes. Okay. Now, I know some people were turned away from NHS hospitals when this happened. Okay, but can you imagine how worse off patients would have been if there were less doctors in the hospital for the month leading up to that? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's really hard to argue that they need to spend more on tech.
I think, you know, you do. You make a valid point, right? I mean, that is their core business, and tech really shouldn't be a thing that they really have to expend a lot of money or effort on. And the problem is, of course, if you had given the NHS, you know, an extra billion quid to spend on upgrading their IT systems, all
tabloid headlines. Tabloid headlines screaming that it's a boondoggle and that's a waste of money and that they're buying shiny new computers for staff while patients are suffering.
And the thing is, they would be right, you know, and the IT vendors would be circling like sharks, gobbling up that money, overcharging and, you know, just being the general, you know, pack of jerks that they are. And you wouldn't get good outcomes. You'd end up with, you know, just another rubbish system to replace it. And to my eyes, I think the thing that we are missing here is taking into account the full cost of these systems. Like, you deploy a computerized system into a hospital, and on the budget, you've got the cost of rolling it out and initially deploying it, and then maybe a little bit of maintenance. But there's no line item in there for what it costs to decommission at the end of life, right? We don't look at the full life cycle cost of IT systems, and that's what we see here, right? I mean, it is an unwillingness to accept what it actually costs to run computerized infrastructure.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, I saw someone tweet, I can't remember who it is, and I'm very sorry if you're listening, but there was an excellent Twitter thread on this saying, well, okay, you know, your £15 million MRI machine uses Windows XP, with SMB1 to do imaging, you cannot update that thing. You know, if you break it, you've got serious problems. And to replace the machine, you need to open the building. You know, there are reasons that hospitals are a horror show when it comes to security. And patching itself, people are like, oh, they should just patch their stuff. When you're dealing with a whole bunch of brittle systems like that, it is even more complicated than the typical enterprise. And I know some people at very large, well-funded institutions with huge security teams that say that patching is 50% of what the security group does. Full stop.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's just crazy town, right? And there are very good reasons why you might not patch stuff, as you've said, yeah. Right? I can think of plenty of critical infrastructure systems that run on Server 2003 that are never, ever going to get patched. And that's fine, right? Mm. You put it on the list, you know what's not patching, and there's 100 other compensating controls you can put around it to make that okay, right? To make it, you accept, yeah, you can't patch
it. Hospitals don't do that because that takes time and expertise and money. But I guess the point I'm trying to get across here is a lot of people are saying, oh, this happened because people are idiots and don't patch. It's more complicated than that. It's not just that people are stupid. It's that people are under-resourced and our tooling. Ultimately, Adam, what needs to happen is our tooling and our operating systems need to get better.
They do, right? This is fundamentally a problem for us as the tech industry to solve. And, you know, slowly, perhaps, you know, a modern iOS phone is certainly better than average compared to a system that's running, you know, an MRI, and a modern Windows 10 box is better than the system that runs, you know, a dam or a power station. And in 50 years' time, when we have a new MRI and a new dam, maybe they will be a little bit better. But, yeah, it's, you know, we, the tech industry, we got to solve this because you can't expect the one IT guy at the hospital to do it.
Yeah, Chromebooks for hospitals could be the cry. And look, also, you know, keep in mind too that when it comes to these hospitals, they're never going to prioritize security spend, you know, over patient outcomes. And any politician who instructs them to do so will be burning an awful lot of political capital and opening up all sorts of liabilities. So that's, and you know, if you were going to fix system-wide something like the NHS, that would be very, very expensive. It would require the budget to come from outside of the individual hospitals, and you would probably need to slap a levy on everyone, you know, like a 0.5% income levy or a tax increase to even fund something like this. And can you imagine burning that sort of political capital? We're giving you a 0.5% one-off, you know, one-year extra tax to pay for new computers for hospitals.
Yeah, like it's going to go down like a lead balloon, eh? And then, of course, the problem is once you get to that kind of money, then the vendors you're going to choose to do that are going to blow that money, right? I mean, if anything, you know, if it's a small enough budget, you can get away and spend your money responsibly and get good outcomes for it. Once you start spending $1 billion on, you know, government-funded procurement of stuff, all you end up is just being screwed by the vendors. So it's just there's no way where this works out well.
This was a worm based on a, you know, SMB V1 exploit, right? And it's caused this much chaos. An actual O-Day worm would have been so much worse. And yeah, I think, we can really treat this as a bit of a drill in that, you know, it shows us what the impact of particularly network worms could be, especially when tied to something like ransomware. I mean, it's like the double threat, right? But I think it really drives home the point that you need to structure your network and your IT systems to deal with the possibility of O-Day. I mean, this is just a big reminder of that in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. O-Day is not new and exciting. And if O-Day means you have to come in and work on Saturday and patch
Let alone something that was patched 2 months ago.
Then you are doing it goddamn wrong. And we saw so many people who were emergency patching over the weekend to try and deal with this when, you know, there was a worm 2 weeks earlier. And can you imagine if the shadow brokers hadn't dropped this after the patch? Like, imagine if they were actual... Yes. I was going to say actual jerks. Like, clearly they're jerks. But, like, imagine if they actually had just dropped this stuff. Or they'd written this worm themselves or used them. Maybe they have used it themselves and they've had enough fun with it. Now it's time to drop it. I don't know. But can you imagine how bad that worm would have been? Or even this worm. If this worm was written by people who actually knew what to do once you'd got remote admin on a Windows box, on a domain, you know, steal some creds, move around, escalate, you know, access to domain admin. Like, I look around the office with the guys I work with and say, well, you know, if one of us wrote that worm, how bad would it have been? And that's the thing. Like, this gives us enough of a drill that wasn't too bad, and we can take some, you know, some chances to improve things. And it's kind of, you know, reminds me of LulzSec in a way, like where we got enough headline traction.
I actually tweeted that. I said I call this the LulzSec effect.
Yeah, maybe we will see a little bit of improvement. But, yeah, God, it could have been – Like with that Tavis AV, by God.
Well, look, I mean, people have said that. People have said that that would have been a lot worse. But given that it spread through mail servers, I mean, there's your throttling point for that, right? It would have been easy to drop at mail gateways.
Well, I mean, Tavis bug, any way you got in front of the scanner, mail, HTTP, anything. Like it wasn't limited
yeah,
to...
Yeah, sure. But I mean, the obvious way to spread that, to get a file onto another machine, that was going to go via email. You know, you would have needed another bug to actually drop the file onto another computer in the first place, unless it was a trusted share. I just don't see that one as being the doomsday scenario. The doomsday scenario would have been this bug 6 months ago.
Well, yeah. And can you imagine what it was like working in the NSA 5 years ago having this bug? Like what
yeah,
easy
lots
mode,
of fun.
Relaxed, you know, super chill, hack and just press button, receive shell, like that.
Yeah.
No, not even that's a try.
But look, let's talk about what would have stopped this, because these guys were too stupid to use, you know, process hollowing, right? And they launched their own process. Whitelisting would have caught this. Building a resilient network would have limited its spread within your organization. AV, quite a lot of AV. I spoke to Martin Gruten briefly, just over Twitter, and he said that a lot of AV actually did catch this. It was easy to catch heuristically. As you'll hear, you know, Silence, this week's sponsor, total coincidence, by the way, that they're on this week, their stuff caught it, which is good. So, I mean, on and on and on we go, but all of those basic things would have actually prevented this. You know, patching, whitelisting, good AV, or, you know, half-decent AV plus good network topology, hey, you're pretty much home and hose.
Yeah, obviously filtering 445 from the internet, you know, is a thing we've been advising, I don't know, since when was the last SMB worm?
But it like only takes one. Ago. That's the thing. It only takes it one does. Box, and there's always going to be one,
there's
right?
There's going to be one
so,
box.
So, yeah. But, you know, I mean, I would never suggest that firewalling, since we saw Slammer and Blaster and those things, actually whip around on LANs, I would never suggest that firewalling is actually even a sensible mitigation for this. Like, you know.
Well, I mean, Windows host firewalling, I guess, is a thing that would have limited somewhat. But yeah, as you say, there is always one. And if this worm had actually propagated, you know, using domain credentials it found, my God, it would have worked so much better. But yeah. In the end.
But isn't that funny that's often the reaction of InfoSec is to actually criticize worm authors and go, if I had wrote it would have been so much more destructive. Do you know what I mean? Like it exposes a lot. Now, look, I should point out too.
what are you saying?
That shadow brokers are threatening to expose information that isn't just related to exploits and whatnot. They're also saying they have a bunch of intelligence, raw intelligence obtained from hacks performed against various countries' nuclear programs. Now that's when we're getting into, you know, that's the real shit. You know what I mean? Like this is heating up. This is the beginning, not the end.
Yeah, you're right. And the sort of the trajectory of cyber-related crazy that we've been on lately is not peaked, right? We're still on the upward slope. And yeah, that's, you know, a group that clearly is credible threatening to drop that kind of stuff. Like it's... Yeah, that's the real deal right there.
All right, look, let's move on through the handful of other stories that managed to get published this week, despite all this happening. And look, it's not technically that much of an InfoSec story, but it's sure as hell going to affect a lot of our listeners. Trump has confirmed that he decided to share some classified intelligence with Russia's foreign minister during a meeting, which is, of course, his right. But I don't think it's going to please the Israelis, whose intelligence he shared. Now, this has been a very big story because apparently what he spoke about could have been compromising for an asset that Israel had planted with the Islamic State. So, you would hope that person is okay and not, you know, wired up to a truck battery right now. But I'm guessing there's a lot of intelligence agencies, including some of the SIGINT agencies that do tune into this program, that are having meetings right now wondering if it's time to start withholding information from the United States that they don't also want to share with Russia or the whole world because, you know,
yeah,
wow.
Exactly right. It's going to get tweeted out. Yeah, you know, you can imagine that you must be considering, even within the US, I'm sure the intelligence agencies are, you know, seriously considering what they are willing to tell the White House, which... I mean, what can you say, right? I mean, that's a mess.
Yeah, I mean, is it
going to
wind up being the Four Eyes Alliance instead of the Five Eyes
Doesn't
Alliance?
Doesn't matter the same
you
room,
really do Like, how much worse does it have to get before we start siginting on our own? And I mean, I can't answer that. And I'm sure there's a lot of people, even indeed in the SIGINT community, who can't answer that because this is just such an unprecedented situation.
Yeah, such a mess.
Such a mess. Trump also signed a cybersecurity executive order, which I'm told was quite reasonable. The first draft was just, you know, idiotic, but this one is apparently pretty good.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, actually, sort of an island of relative sanity amongst all of the other crazy that's going on. The this order, we did talk about it a couple of months ago now, and it is, yeah, surprisingly sensible. It's basically, you know, go out, spend 6 months figuring out what the actual problems are, come up with a plan to do something about it, and then come back and report on it. So, you know, it's a plan to have a plan, but that's better than nothing, and it's not crazy. So that
no, and in fact, they've stolen the best bit from out the way we do it here in Australia. You know, all federal government agencies in Australia are required to do things via ACSI 33, which is now known as the ISM, the Information Security Manual, which is created by the defensive arm of the Australian Signals Directorate. So, you know, the US government is instructing all federal government departments to adhere to the NIST framework for improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity. That is a good move.
Yeah, it is.
It works. It actually does work because it gives people an actual idea of what they should be doing, and that's a great start.
Yeah, and we're seeing this, you know, get kind of updated with some sensible recommendations, for example, around password rotation and password length that reflects more modern thinking like that. You know, this is a good step, actually, surprisingly.
Yeah. Yeah, well done. WikiLeaks has really managed to master the press cycle here because it's made such a splash. actually, no, it hasn't. In news that barely anyone has noticed, WikiLeaks has dumped some more Vault 7 material, a couple of CIA malware frameworks, which I'm sure is, you know, exciting for some people in the malware analysis side of things, and they'll be, you know, creating signatures that will probably not fire on anything because all of the CIA people would have cleaned up their ops by now. But still, it's fun to see how they do things.
Yeah, no, there's useful insight. And of course, I mean, having some way to go back and look at samples that you've seen from ages ago that you've got in the vault somewhere and attribute those now is really useful. The thing I took away from this particular one is that the CIA has way better names for stuff than the NSA. Their After Midnight kind of implant thing accepts kind of loadable modules to do extra functionality. And they're called Gremlins, which is way cooler than any of the NSA names. I think,
you know, it's funny because that's like the third time you've mentioned that about Vault 7 leaks. Like every week it's like, oh yeah, no, cool names.
It's way better than the NSA. The CIA look like they have more fun hacking stuff than the NSA. That's what I reckon.
Oh man, this next story is just incredible. HP laptops were apparently logging user keystrokes for I don't know why. I don't even know why. And they were storing logged keystrokes in, drumroll please, a public folder.
Yeah, they appear to have bought some device drivers from Conexant, I presume the upstream vendor of some of their like audio and other bits and pieces in their laptops. And the drivers provided by Conexant for like the keyboard hotkeys for like controlling the brightness and the monitor output settings and that kind of thing. Rather than use the regular Windows infrastructure that you're supposed to do for like registering hotkeys, they just decided to sniff the raw scan codes off the keyboard. And then they left debug mode turned on and yeah, they logged them disk in the clear. The log does get zeroed every boot, but you know, there's still going to be stuff in there from the first time.
It saves you from having to write your own keylogger, doesn't it? When you've just got to write a batch, you know, which just grabs what it's already collected and shunts it off. So there is that. Apple has patched a whole bunch of pwn-to-own vulnerabilities in Safari, macOS, and iOS. I'm wondering, Adam, if perhaps they've slipped in a few extra bugs that may have come from a certain institution around Fort Meade, around that area?
Yeah, that was it's going to be interesting to see, isn't it? I mean, there's definitely some bugs in here that we know the origin of. There's a couple from the Google Project Zero team, and there's a bunch of SQLite bugs that are actually quite interesting. But yeah, there might be a few ones that we'll see the Shadow Brokers drop in June that will turn out to have been patched by Apple right about now. So yeah, keep an eye on that one.
Vice Motherboard has an interesting story here about Dutch police busting another PGP BlackBerry company. It's just so funny that there are so many, you know, BlackBerry plus PGP companies that have sprung up to sort of serve organized crime, and they keep getting busted and good. I mean, I remember reading like, geez, 8-9 years ago about how the biker gangs here, who are real, you know, serious business here in Australia, how they were actually using BlackBerries bought in Mexico and stuff. And it's just interesting that this is still a thing in the age of like Signal and WhatsApp. But I guess, yeah, kind of makes sense. Sort of.
Yeah. It appears that people made real money out of it. The Dutch police seized a mansion worth 1.6 million euros and 2 million euros in cash. So that's a good haul, clearly.
And finally, Adam, overnight, sometime in the next 24 hours, Chelsea Manning will be walking free from prison.
Yeah, and about time. Hear, hear.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting, and we'll just have to see if there's any public statements. Chelsea is apparently staying with the army. There's some sort of arrangement whereby she is not being discharged. I think it's the idea is that she can still receive some medical benefits and whatnot. So seems like maybe getting a fair run from the Department of Defense at the moment. But I'm guessing that will also prevent her from making any public statements, which might explain the benevolence. So yeah, that's that. And mate, that is actually it for the week's news. And wow, I'm glad we finally got through all of that, because I've just spent, you know, just it's been a mad 5 days just getting through everything.
Yeah, no, it really has. Like getting on top of this when it initially broke on Saturday, and then just trying to make sense of all of the different, you know, different pieces and all of the angles that people have taken. And yeah, and the rubbish reporting that we've seen in so many mainstream articles about this. Yeah, just making sense of all that. It's been a very full week. So yeah. Yes, I too am glad to see the back of the WannaCry worm.
And I finally need to correct one more thing. People are saying that, you know, this happening now is proof that the Risky Business holiday curse has been broken because I wasn't on vacation. Well, I do have some bad news for you.
Little do they know.
I've got bad news for you on two fronts, actually. The first thing is I actually took last Friday off, which is when it broke here. I got back to my hotel. I flew down to an awards night in Sydney. And when I got back to my hotel, it was all kicking off. So I did have that day off, technically on vacation. And in a few weeks, I'm going to spend time on a beach in Indonesia.
Oh, shit.
It's going to be very relaxing. So Blue Teamers, set your alert con to, you know, 17 or whatever it is. And, you know, end times are nigh.
They certainly are. If you're going to go sit on the beach, we're all doomed. Doomed, doomed, doomed. We should also point out that when Pat says he went to an awards dinner, he did actually win said award. So congratulations, Pat. Yet another fine journalism award.
Thank you very much. Yes, Lizzie for best security journalist, which is a new category. So yes, that was very fun. And Darren Pawley, also Claire Connolly, but Darren Pawley, I was very happy to see, scored himself a highly commended in that category. So that was great.
Yeah, go Dazza.
Okay, Adam. Well, mate, you are free now to go have a Bex and a good lie down, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. We'll talk to you then. Hopefully, it's not all ruined.
That was Adam Boileau there with a recap of WannaCry and the other security news of the week. And boy, am I glad to have got through that. It has been, as I mentioned, you know, really crazy week picking through all of this. And it's been amazing to me to see this thing unfold the way that it has with such a lack of technical detail. And I do want to thank everyone who helped me out in terms of getting the detail that I could get. And you know who you are. And yeah, too many to name there. I've been speaking to a lot of people. We are going to stay with WannaCry now in this week's sponsor interview, and this week's show is brought to you by Cylance. That's C-Y-L-A-N-C-E. They make a machine learning-based AV solution that thankfully caught WannaCry on day zero. Apparently, a bunch of AV engines did actually catch this one. Not all of them. If you go by virus total, it was 30%, but Martin Gruten of Virus Bulletin actually says that the real number is a little higher than that. But Stuart McClure is Cylance's co-founder and CEO, and he joins me now to talk about the lack of technical analysis that was available to everyone 5 days after this outbreak. He's going to speculate on why that is. You know, as I said, we don't know which versions of Windows are affected. We don't know if email was an initial vector because a lot of people are conflating Jaff with WannaCry and so on and so on. Stuart also joins me to talk about some of the shameful ambulance chasing that's been going on. Cylance did fire off a couple of tweets to let customers know that they would be okay, but they haven't played that game really at all, or at least nearly as hard as others, and I'll get his thoughts on that. But yes, first up, Stuart, you're the CEO of an AV company. Why is there such a lack of good technical analysis on this malware? Tell me.
I think the problem is two parts. Number one is, you know, the fog of war when these things happen is pretty thick. You know, we get pulled into 1,000 different places and have to chase 10,000 rabbit holes looking for what is associated with this attack. What is it really doing out there in the world? And, you know, when we start to see these kinds of things, we go immediately into action to reverse engineer it and to get it going. But I think there's also been sort of a fear to be wrong in this one. Because
that hasn't stopped plenty of people, let me tell you.
I know. But like those that actually want to produce, you know, just the purest of content and not be wrong, you know, it takes a little time. You know, we have to think about it. Get a bunch of folks that really smart are looking at the same problem and making sure that it's saying exactly what we're seeing and wanting it to say. So I think that's also added to the delay a bit. But, you know, it's just been a really interesting one, because there's only a few that I can sort of recall back in memory where, okay, so some, you know, zero day that was repurposed or stolen or whatever from some other tranche is now pushed into, you know, ScriptKitty's version of a happy worm that goes out there. But I think we're just sort of wanting to be careful, make sure we say the most accurate thing about these things, and then get as complete of a review as possible.
Sure, but it's been nearly 5 days. You know what I mean?
I know.
And I can't say which, like, why has no one just fired it up in the lab, you know what I mean, and figured out as simple as which versions of Windows does this affect?
Well, I think, you know, we can cheat on that one, right, and just poke to the MS-17010, you know, to sort of say, well, at least the SMB exploitation vector is, you know, affected on these version of Windows. But yeah, when it comes to the actual, you know, ransomware portion, then yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just been really difficult to kind of get in. So I think for a few things. Number one, we've had a gazillion versions of this thing out there now. I mean, last time I checked on VirusTotal, there's something like over 400, 500. I think that was last night. I think there's more today, right?
Yeah.
And then of course we got stockpiles of others that we're getting from customers that are being blocked that we don't know that's being associated, because we just block if it's bad. We don't know why it's bad. We just know it's bad. So we have to go through and do our analysis as well. So I think there's a lot of that. There's just so much data to go through. And, you know, we're going down a lot of red herrings. Like, we had a customer that was hit with something who didn't have any of our product installed on it, because they wanted to see if it would get popped. And sure enough, they did. And then they thought it was WannaCry, but it ended up being Jaff ransomware.
Yeah, Jaff. A lot of people – see, another thing we don't really know, and I'm getting conflicting information on, is the initial vector for this thing, as we heard it earlier in the show. Like, it's not even clear what the initial seed was for this. And you'd think if it was email – I've had one person in my DMs, you know, a respectable person, trustworthy person, saying, yeah, absolutely, the initial vector in our organization was email. And yet we do not see any vendors out there with samples saying, you know, here it is, and this is where we could have stopped it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've checked personally with government too, UK, US, they don't have a definitive header that I know of that represents sort of the first patient zero on getting this on a box. So could it be? Sure. You know, maybe even a web link serving it up somewhere. That could have been it. I think the obvious choice is simply, well, it was run somewhere in the world and someone was plugged in somewhere on the internet, got popped, and then it just turned around and started to go inside these organizations.
Yeah, like, it was an internet cafe in Karachi or some shit, right? Like, and that's the thing, like, how 15 years ago is this? It's really incredible. And this is the type of situation that makes vendors break out in cold sweats, because, you know, you never really know till something like this happens. Whether or not your technology has actually succeeded. From what I understand, though, you guys dodged this bullet. Silence, I believe, stopped this one. All versions at all times, or were there any infections of computers that were running Silence?
None that we know of. I mean, we have over 6,000 customers, over, you know, 5 million endpoints now protected. All the customer cases that we've seen have been blocks, prevents.
Okay, well, you know, breathe a big sigh of relief. So that's great. But a lot of other vendors, on the other hand, have been doing the old ambulance chasing. I mean, I've seen upwards of 20 pitches in my inbox with everyone wanting to, you know, comment on this. The weirdest one for me was Splunk. Splunk talking about, you know, something impacting a host, because I'm thinking, what would Splunk actually do to prevent this? I'm guessing they just draw you a really pretty graph of precisely how owned you are. Do you know what I mean? Why are they jumping in this?
I know. That's hilarious. I have to imagine it'd be something like that. I'm not quite sure how they would spin it and pitch it. Maybe take them up on the offer, see what they have to say. Yeah,
exactly right. Now, look, I haven't seen an ambulance chase pitch from a PR agency connected to Silence. Was that a deliberate decision?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, for us that have been doing this a long, long time, you know, my reputation, Ryan's reputation, the whole team's like, we can't be doing that kind of stuff. It's sort of our greatest strength and our greatest weakness in the industry, is that we will not jump on the bandwagon of this stuff in sort of an exploitive way, because we know how sensitive it all is. But at the same time, you know, we want people to know that we did prevent this all zero day.
I mean, look, that's what I saw from you was, you know, I mean, there was a couple of tweets to customers and notifications to customers saying, yes, just for your information, you are okay on this one. But that's very different to pitching every single InfoSec journalist in the world and saying, hey, we can talk about this because we stopped it and we're amazing.
That's exactly right. I mean, a lot of what we try to do is just stay grounded, stay real, just grateful for what we've been able to deliver in the tech.
Look, I mean, I suppose no matter how good your tech is, right, there's still going to be that cold sweat moment where you actually wonder if it worked because nothing's perfect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. Like, look, we never say we're 100%. You know, we will never say that we are 100%. I sort of laugh when I hear that comment in the security industry. But you're right. Like that first morning when I got that call at 3 a.m., I'm like, oh, you know, dear God, please. Please, God, if you love anyone, please.
Please let our model catch this, right?
Please let the model catch it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's...
And so the panic, you know, is just in us. Like, oh my gosh, so we're up immediately. We're pulling on every sample we can get. We're calling in favors from anybody and everybody and the victims and everything. And trying to get samples. And so until we get the samples, until we run them, and until we see it on our you know, product, we don't tell a word, our soul, because we're trying to get them, we're trying to understand it first. And then once we have a kind of a complete understanding, then we push out to customers. We push it out to sales if they need and things like that. But it's just nerve-wracking.
The effect on listed security companies has been crazy. I think I saw something yesterday where FireEye was up 7%, which is weird. Do you know what I mean? But like, there you go. Yeah. That's what Wall Street's going to Wall Street, right? One thing that struck me as odd too, just about anyone trying to do marketing around this, is I'd imagine that most of the machines that have been impacted by this would have been unmanaged boxes without secondary security controls anyway. Do you know what I mean? People are giving Sophos a lot of shit because, you know, there was their website that said, you know, Sophos totally protects the NHS, which got completely hosed in this. And now they've changed it to, you know, Sophos gets the understands the NHS's security needs or something like that. Something a little less extreme. But even then, I'm guessing that any box with any well-managed box, you know, wouldn't have been impacted by this anyway. So it seems a little odd for the security industry to do any marketing around this. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, you're right in the one aspect, like if you were just kept current on the patches, I mean, you probably wouldn't have gotten hit, right? If you had been hit, you probably wouldn't have been hit, because I think the worm propagation is what caught most everybody. But I think, you know, our ability to protect just as an industry is so horrible because it's so reactive. You know, you have to see a victim first and then create a signature, either heuristic or anything else, and then push out as quickly as humanly possible. And so I think the real storyline in all of this is, you know, well, how did this happen? Like, how is it so easy for this type of a worm and this type of a piece of ransomware to be wormified and get it exploiting systems willy-nilly on the network and on the computers? Now, if you had patched and it had been sent on in a fish or in some sort of URL link, then I'm sure we would have seen a big blip in ransomware, this particular type, WannaCry or WCry, but it would never have reached the scale that it did without that O-Day, unpatched O-Day.
Well, I mean, it wasn't O-Day at that point, right? So
not at that point. Exactly.
Not at that point. Yeah. It was like 30-day. One thing I'm curious about too is, like, why do malware authors actually launch new processes that you can then inspect? When they're using a memory corruption bug like this, why don't they just hijack the process that they're exploiting and load their stuff into that? Because then you're not going to see it, are you?
Well, that's right. Sometimes there are technical reasons, like the memory space allocated for that process, or, you know, the ability to spawn another process that allows for flexibility or control over the environment. Stuff like that might be limited. I don't know particularly. Perhaps if there was a technical reason why, I can't speculate.
Because I'm just thinking specifically in the case of ransomware, it's not like keyloggers and things that are doing complicated things with browsers. Right. They don't need much memory. All they need is privilege, right? So we could actually see a ransomware come around that AV that is invisible to AV because it's just thinking that it's the SMB process that's doing its thing. You know?
This could have been 10 times worse, I guarantee you, right? So you look at like SQL Slammer. That was the first question that came out of my mind when that hit. It was sort of like, wait, single UDP packet, single.
235 bytes, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Something like that literally took over the box. You could have done whatever you wanted to, but just crashed it, right? So it could have done much worse. So it almost felt like a trial balloon a bit. Like, what could we do with this? I don't know. Motivation wise, it's always fun to speculate with a beer in hand. But other than that, there's not much to it. I do agree with you, though. If they would have just done a huge process hollowing technique, you know, and really started to go to town, it could have been even worse.
Yeah. Or if this was based on Tavis's, you know, Windows Defender bug, that would have been a horror show. But
that would have been
but at least the mail providers, because mail would have been the vector then, at least the mail providers would have been able to, you know, filter it pretty reliably. You know what I mean? But I mean, what's great about this is it's just reminded people of what it might. This is, you know, with a 30-day patch bug, right? Like, what would a worm look like, you know, based on O-Day? And it would be a total freaking meltdown. Now, look, Microsoft has pretty squarely taken aim at the NSA over this. They have written a blog post. Their chief counsel has written a blog post saying, O-Day stockpiles and that sort of thing. Where do you land on this? Because blaming someone has become everyone's favorite hobby on this. Who do you blame, Stuart?
You know what I blame? I simply blame the fact that we have systems that are vulnerable and we don't do much to protect against it. You know, I think ultimately, how can you blame, you know, those that are, I mean, certainly if you're doing things malicious and such like that, but look, there's always going to be people that want to bypass software. There's always going to be people that, whether it be good or bad, that try to exploit software. So the choke point really is the development of that software. I mean, that's the core of the problem.
So you're not prepared to stand here and say, wah, NSA, or wah, Microsoft, or wah, North Korea.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I agree with you, right? Like, it's the whole thing. You got to look at it from a macro sense. Like, trying to scapegoat here is just really counterproductive. And I'm kind of surprised to see Microsoft doing that, you know? Like, are you a bit surprised to see Microsoft trying to throw any, you know, deflect anything off them onto NSA?
I think what would have been much more powerful is for them to come out and say, here's the bug. This is how it was introduced. This is how it missed all of our QA. And this is what we're doing to fix it. Like, to me, that's powerful, because just coming forward, taking ownership, saying, look, this is how these things
happen.
This
is our part. Here's what we're doing about our part of this. Yeah.
Right. We're not perfect. We never will be, but we will constantly, inevitably, universally try everything that we in our power to prevent these kinds of things.
So do you see their blog post as a little bit of a deflection move? Because that's entirely how I have it pegged.
Yeah, I just think I don't know what's going on with that rationale. That's bottom line. Yeah.
So you're with me on that, or that's a little bit? You seem like you're hedging a little bit there, Stuart.
I don't presume to be in the halls, you know, in any operating system provider, and I know the challenges of software development. What I will just simply say is that there is always better ways to create some more secure software, and I think the more you take accountability, the more powerful it is for the customer and for employees to get better all the time. And I think we can all do better.
Stuart McClure, thank you very much for joining us on the show to share with us the industry view.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Stuart McClure of Cylance there. You can check them out at cylance.com, cylance.com. Again, they make machine learning-based AV that works, by all reports, very, very well. And a consistent bit of feedback I get from its customers is that it's also very easy to deploy and manage, which is a big thing for a lot of people. So yeah, big thanks to Cylance for sponsoring this week's show. And that is it for this week's episode. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.